This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, we heard the New York Times' national editor and Democratic debate co-moderator Mark Lacy ask Senator Elizabeth Warren the question about health care we have now come to expect.
You have not specified how you're going to pay for the most expensive plan, Medicare for All. Will you raise taxes on the middle class to pay for it, yes or no?
So I have made clear what my principles are here, and that is costs will go up for the wealthy and for big corporations, and for hardworking middle class families, costs will go down.
But that wasn't a yes or no answer to a yes or no question, so Lacy persisted.
Senator Warren, to be clear, Senator Sanders acknowledges he's going to raise taxes on the middle class to pay for Medicare for All. You've endorsed his plan. Should you acknowledge it? Senator Warren, will you acknowledge what the senator just said about taxes going up?
And Warren dodged, as she's been dodging for months.
So the way I see this, it is about what kinds of costs middle-class families are going to face. Costs are going to go up for the wealthy. They're going to go up for big corporations. They will not go up for middle-class families, and I will not sign a bill into law that raises their costs, because costs are what people care about.
It looked like a tough journalist holding an evasive politician to account. But was it? As the Huffington Post's Arthur Delaney reported this week, Warren's point is correct. Households would inevitably face those higher taxes, she won't acknowledge out loud, but also have much lower outlays for health care. Net-net, she claims, it's at least a wash, which is why Delaney thinks the "will taxes go up" trope is the worst debate question of the cycle. He joins me now. Arthur, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
In your piece, you cite a couple of main reasons the tax increase query is the worst debate question. First, you say it's argumentative and a trap along "do you still beat your wife" lines.
That's absolutely right, because it zeroes in on the most unfavorable aspect of a pretty complicated policy proposal.
With the understanding that an honest answer is going to be political ammunition for the Republicans.
Both the moderator and the candidate know that just giving a straight yes is bad politics, and both know that that's what the answer is. But it's tough, because not answering directly isn't very good either.
And as you observe, it's a false metric, because it presumes that the only issue is tax liability versus overall household outlays, right?
The reason people don't like taxes is that they cost money. So if you're going to zero in on taxes when the actual trade-off proposed is something that theoretically would cost people less money, then it's misleading to focus on the taxes.
But if a politician doesn't want to say something out loud, the journalistic instinct is to get them to say it. And the more the politician strains not to answer, the more urgent the answer seems. Now, obviously, a so-called simple yes or no answer is often misleading and devoid of context. But is it the journalist's job to worry about, you know, downstream political ramifications for the candidate?
It's not. But in this case, we've had the question put to Elizabeth Warren at least 8 times, including in previous debates, and we know what her answer is. She gave that answer over and over when she was presented with this question on Tuesday, and her answer actually does imply that, yes, taxes are part of the equation. That's why she says costs are going to go down. So at some point, you do want to press as a journalist. But you also want to recognize when you've gotten as much as you can get, and you can still have this conversation about trade-offs and taxes without continuing to bang your head against a wall.
All right, but beyond that is your second objection, that the gotcha in the gotcha question is premised on a false understanding of voter sentiment, that taxation is always a non-starter, a no-fly zone. You know, George H.W. Bush and all that.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
So for years, Americans have told Gallup, they've told Pew, that they're not most upset about what they themselves pay. The thing that bothers them most about taxes is the idea that corporations and the wealthy aren't paying their fair share. And majorities of people have said that they think their own tax burden is fair.
You pointed to the work of a scholar named Vanessa Williamson, who tried to understand the Tea Party as a backlash to Barack Obama's presidency. And what did she learn?
So Vanessa Williamson, when she was interviewing Tea Party protesters, you know, she asked them what they were mad about. They would preface their gripe by saying, as a taxpayer, and it made her wonder, if taxes are so toxic, why are these people who are protesting seemingly so proud of paying taxes? And she pursued that apparent contradiction in a book called Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. And she finds that the notion of taxes really goes to how you feel about America and who you think this country is for.
And this is where we get into such a can of worms, because lower taxes and less government spending have been bedrock conservative principles and mantras for decades. But you believe that reflects not a paradox, but just more evidence of structural racism, because conservatives don't mind paying taxes as long as the money doesn't go to freeloaders.
This is something that's, I think, pretty robust in academic literature, that according to surveys, people's attitudes toward government spending and taxes are heavily correlated with their attitudes toward African Americans. This is people who say in surveys that they think most of the reason for African Americans' economic disadvantage is their own effort rather than discrimination, and that people who feel that way tend to also object to higher taxes and more government spending.
So tax and spend rhetoric is really just the ultimate dog whistle. But sometimes they don't whistle it. They just say it. Like in 2012, when Republican senator and then presidential candidate Mitt Romney told a group of wealthy donors 47% of the country pays no federal income tax.
They're victims who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them.
Believes they're entitled to government welfare and would never vote for him.
47% of Americans pay no income tax.
When Romney said that at a fundraiser, he was really just articulating a common meme in conservative media, which is that most people aren't taxpayers. And it's actually not true. He was focused on the federal income tax. And in that case, everybody who earns a paycheck is a federal taxpayer because social insurance taxes are taken out of your first dollar of income.
Another thing that Romney left out, and what critics of the freeloaders don't seem to internalize, is that they are freeloaders too. There are ways to benefit from big government largesse that aren't direct cash benefits, but huge subsidies. Here was historian Molly Michelmore on our program in 2017.
The home mortgage interest deduction, for example. It is the United States' de facto housing policy. We spend far more in revenues lost to the home mortgage interest deduction than we do on public housing. But because it's done through the tax code, it does not feel like a benefit.
But it is middle class welfare, you could call it. She talked about the mortgage interest deduction. There's also untaxed employer contributions to health insurance and, you know, other benefits that many Americans receive essentially through tax subsidies.
The tax preference for employer-sponsored health insurance is one of the very biggest in the federal tax code. It's $300 billion annually, which is the size of four food stamp programs, for example, and nobody knows about it. But that's the whole reason we have the wacky public-private patchwork health insurance system that we do in this country.
But once again, there's no stigma attached to that. That's reserved for recipients of direct aid, which fuels the tax and spend nanny state freeloader rhetoric, which leads to gotcha debate questions, huh?
That's right. I think because we've had decades of politics in which welfare has been bashed and where welfare was often associated with African Americans and people of color, that there is just an understanding among many voters that big government is not for me. Meanwhile, there are all these big government programs that are either not regarded as welfare because people don't know about them or because they just have a special status and they're funded by contributions rather than taxes, which is a rhetorical trick that FDR put into play 100 years ago.
It actually goes back to the Democrats. You say they laid this trap for themselves dating back to the 30s and the creation of Social Security.
It's not a new trick. When they made Social Security, which is probably the most popular and successful social program in American political history, they often said, this is not a tax we're using to pay for this program. These are contributions that workers make to an annuity that they will later receive, which is not really true. They don't put that money in the safe, but it makes people feel really good about earning Social Security benefits. Whereas with welfare programs, that's just a handout.
And the implicit message, whether FDR, you know, thought this through or not, was contributions good, taxes bad. So bad that when he needed to finance, what do you call it, World War II, he had to turn for political help, not across the aisle, but across species.
When they wanted to raise income taxes in order to help pay for World War II, the FDR administration hired Walt Disney to make a cartoon propaganda video.
Are you a patriotic American?
Yes, sir!
Eager to do your part?
Yes, sir!
Then there's something important you can do.
Oh, boy, I'll do it!
Your income tax.
Income tax?
In which a narrator tells Donald Duck, you gotta pay taxes to beat the Axis. I'm sorry, but this is all Hitler's fault.
What about the post-war environment and the language used in the Great Society and after in order to underwrite social entitlements and government welfare and other big spending?
A key moment was when the Kennedy administration was pushing tax cuts in the 60s. This was amid growing furor over welfare programs, which they decided not to defend. Instead, they said, we are going to improve the economy by cutting taxes and therefore giving people more of their own money to spend, which will increase aggregate demand and reduce the welfare caseloads because more people will have jobs. So they switched to this argument about managing the economy as technocrats through tax cuts rather than make an affirmative defense of the state by saying that actually these welfare programs aren't so bad. And this is basically the rhetoric we've been living with ever since. We're in a policy stalemate where both sides are tax cutters, and nobody wants to say taxes are good.
Are you saying that by couching all of these programs in that way, that the Democrats were implicitly kind of refusing to address the very kind of question that Elizabeth Warren had to face in the debate?
That's right. And maybe they made a good strategic decision at all these junctures in the 20th century, but that's how we got where we are. And as a result, leave aside Medicare for All, Democratic candidates and current members of Congress have a lot of proposals to ameliorate hardship in America, to make life better for working and non-working people. And they almost all use the tax code. They say this is just an expansion of the earned income tax credit. It's not a government program.
But it's all vaguely disingenuous. It's not the kind of thing that builds public trust in government if they're chronically, over a period of decades, not really saying the thing that is the nub of it.
I mean, that's the argument against doing it this way. You are sort of concealing the role of government in making people's lives better, and it puts you in a policy trap where you are unable to make those arguments, and the tax code just keeps getting whittled down and, you know, coming up with a new program to get out of a policy problem is increasingly difficult.
The phrasing, you know, how are you going to pay for it, has a very familiar ring. Isn't that a question that politicians have been facing on all matter of policy proposals since time immemorial?
Yes, and they've had that question for all their other policy proposals for child care and things like that. And they generally say, well, we'll make the rich pay for it, which is a really easy dodge. Taxing the rich is really popular. People like the idea of taxing the rich, even if it's not to pay for something, just to do it. But with something as ambitious as Medicare for All. It's not clear that it would work. This is a high standard, though, I must say. Republicans, a couple years ago, passed a huge tax law that added more than $1 trillion to the deficit and basically waved away questions of how you're going to pay for it.
Arthur, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter covering politics for The Huffington Post. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.